Hi, and welcome to the episode of CineNation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz in the beautiful Portland, Oregon.
I'm Thomas Horton.
And I'm Hunter Barcroft from Atlanta, Georgia. This is CineNation, officially.
And we're back after a month of vacation absence.
And working for Brandon.
I'm sorry. Hunter's been working for me. And Ben was there, too.
I was in a starring extra role.
Just so you guys know, over the break, over the holidays, we made a film in Alabama. Hunter was production designer. I was writing and directing. Ben Gertz was a lovely extra with smoking herbal cigarettes and not eating a cheeseburger that was put in front of him.
The herbal that you might think of.
Ben had the hardest job of all. He had to not eat a Five Guys burger and fries in front of him and also smoke nasty herbal cigarettes.
It was definitely dedication to the craft. I can say that much.
It was sacrifice for the film on the level of Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant.
Oh yeah, it was just like that.
I crawled out of the gravel parking lot and denied myself that burger.
And then Thomas was off in South Carolina, even though he gave a script.
Yeah,
notes,
providing.
Thomas and Anna's cameo.
Oh yeah, Thomas and Anna's cameo. I forgot about that. I saw that.
You sent me a Snapchat.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
We put in one scene. There was a kitchen scene that we put Anna and Thomas's pictures on the refrigerator, to where they're actually in the film. Well, so there
thank you.
That was fun.
That's a Hunter did that, and I was like, yes, we have.
I actually
to do it.
Paid money to print out a photo of Thomas. It was heartbreaking when I did it. I was like, I'll never forgive myself. But yeah,
that's okay. I paid $15 for a scene I was doing last semester to now. I own like a full sized poster board printout of a picture of a pancake.
Holy crap.
So if you need
it. I do need that. That would be amazing.
Yeah. It's just a huge
pancake. We had that big boy Shoney's bobblehead in there somewhere at one point.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Some good stuff, man. Yeah, we did some good stuff in there.
It was a grueling film. Not as grueling as The Revenant.
It was close.
But it was close. There were some nights where there were some points. I know Ben wanted to ask some questions about this film that we did, because since we do talk about movies on here. I will say at one point we were just all, it was like 14-hour days, and about day two, I was like, I don't know if I want to do this for the rest of my life. I was like, I don't know if I think I just want to go write scripts and edit in a room by myself.
Oh,
because
I want Ben. It was Ben, ask us about our breaking points. I want to tell you my breaking point, but I'll let it come up later on because it is.
Hunter,
really
during the production of the film, what would you say was the closest you came to a breaking point?
Oh, thank you, Ben.
It's the same as
Thank
mine.
You, James
same
Lipton. Basically, the last night we're shooting in this tiny little apartment. It was perfect. Like, we switched over to a different apartment to film in, like, literally the night before at 3 in the morning. So we had Brandon had never even seen this apartment. He just trusted me. I was like, it's perfect for what we need. We'll do it. So we're in there. We're filming. It's like a long night. So it's like 1 in the morning.
It's like about 12:30
12:30, John Walks and I are moving a chair from one room to another room as we're switching scenes. The chair lands on the ground a little too hard. Not like hard, but you know, like it makes a noise. The people underneath us, in the apartment underneath us, just start like banging on the floor. It sounds like a bear is trying to like rip up through the floor. And they're just like, bang, 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 bang. They're just banging on it for like a solid 10 minutes. We're all just like, oh God, they're going to come kill us. Like we're dead, like this whole production's over, we're gonna have to like stop filming, and it was a nightmare. And so then a security guard came up and talked to us, and he was like, you guys, this is like a noise complaint, you gotta keep it down. We're like, oh, okay, so we try to be more quiet. So about an hour later, Dusty, our sound guy, Dusty Fields, he was been on a show before. He was planning a mic in the bedroom for one of the bedroom scenes on a shelf. And the shelf is like mounted up on the wall. I don't know. She mounted it like poorly. It was held up by like twigs, basically. And so he puts this mic up there. The whole shelf falls. All her jewelry, everything on the shelf falls. Makes this huge crash right into the bedroom.
Crash, yes.
Complete disaster. We're all just staying there like, oh my God, what just happened? Like, what are we gonna do?
Yeah, I walk in and Dusty's standing over just like this pile of stuff. He's like, I don't know what happened. I was just trying to put a mic. I was just like, we're getting kicked out. Like, that's it.
And
like,
this is where I'm at my boiling point. Like, I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm losing my sanity. It was like everything was like all the stuff that was dressed in the scene was just like, it was just all ending. It was all crashing down. It was like my Revenant moment. It was like I got mauled by a bear.
Producer in me is just going like, how much money are we gonna owe the person who lives in that apartment by the end of
it? Oh my, yeah, dude, it was, we fixed it, it gets better, it gets better, okay, so this is my breaking point. And I put the thing back up there. I'm like, okay guys, let's just get through this, it's the last scene here and let's go. I'm just ready to go. So at this point we have like one more company move at 2 a.m. Yes, a company move at 2 a.m.
I also got that Snapchat.
Yeah.
Heck of a, I was going, my head was hitting the pillow as you were making another company move.
Oh, thank you so much, Thomas. So basically, right before our next company move, we're like halfway through the next scene, and I decided to go ahead and cut loose my prop master, Adrian, for the night, because we didn't need her for the next scene. There's no props involved. So I tell her she can leave. She's like, okay, cool. You sure you don't need me? Okay, yeah. So she's on her way out the door. She turns. There's this giant old, you know how like people hang up glass windows on their walls now, like decoratively? Like old glass windows, like the old frames and everything? So there's one of those that we took down and it was leaning against the couch. She turns, and as she turns, her like hip bumps into it. And I just see it in slow motion just tilting over, and it's going to crash all over the floor. And I just like, no. And I just watched it slowly fall, smash. It cracks on one side. It was the loudest noise I've ever heard. And it was at 2 a.m. And yeah, I died inside. My soul died.
Yeah. And let's not forget, at the same exact time, we had tripped a breaker.
Yeah. And so they're trying to get the lights back on. They're like talking, being loud.
Yeah.
Then this thing just crashes. It was just complete chaos.
Our actor, Alec, described Hunter as seeing his soul leave his body.
I did, dude.
That's what he said. It's like he went to say no, and it was like, nah, and just stopped. And he goes, he just went dead. It's just, he was just sitting there.
I had
like
this
not
blanket that was over me, and I just threw it over my head and sat there in silence, with this, just hoping that it would all end. And then we come into moves and difficult. We finished the movie. And I sprayed down.
We did.
Had to wet down a street.
Yeah, we did.
A whole street downtown Tuscaloosa with a hose at 3 a.m. Yeah. That was fantastic, dude.
People were just driving by.
Yeah, I was like a crazy person.
The film. Yeah, just listening to music, just watering a street in 35-degree
weather. People driving by had to be like, why is there a dude standing out in the street with a 300-foot hose spraying this pavement down in 20-degree weather in the middle of January? Like, they had to be so confused. Man.
I was surprised the cops were not called. But anyway, it was a fun, grueling process. It was a great learning experience for all of us. And hopefully you guys will see it at some point in the future because we're starting to edit.
I got a question for Ben.
And
Ben, what's it like being on one of our sets, Ben? What's it like being in one of the talent, yes.
One of the best. You know what I think I loved about it most, Hunter, and this is maybe going to make you a little sad, but the fact that I was there as an extra and to see you guys, I haven't seen a lot of folks on set for quite a while. I was so chill because I knew I had nothing that I could do and should do. And so I was just like, I'm here as an extra. I'm a hick. I'm dressed up in camo with a big hat. It's funny. It's a big hat. It's funny. And so I just sat there and I drank it up and thought, you know, I don't have to do this anymore. Or I do other things now a little bit. And so it was the calmest I've ever been on a set. And at the same time, seeing the chaos, I was just like, I wish I could do more, but here I am. But it was good.
You did help him hang lights.
You did help me
hang
the garland outside.
Yeah, garland.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not useless, but it's just, you know, usually I am thinking along those producer lines, like
yeah,
like you're saying, Thomas. I'm thinking like, all right, how many hours are we burning, mm-hmm. how much food do we have to buy if we go long, you know, all those things are going through my mind, and I'm like, no, not my deal.
What I was thinking during the whole like scenario of all the chaotic events happening was like, okay, what apartment can we fake to make it like this apartment?
None.
Because like it, there was none. We had it. I was thinking of another way to shoot this elsewhere, and it was. And also during it, when we're shooting outside in 28 degree weather at one point, I'm just like, why did I decide to write a Christmas movie outside for scenes? I don't know. Like why? Yeah, this would be fun.
Yeah, dude.
No.
Hats off to the G&E guys setting up that giant rig at 1 a.m. in the freezing cold.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Those guys deserve all the credit in the world. That was amazing. I was so glad I was
John
inside.
Watts, oh, Tanner man. Robbins, Mark Patterson.
Yeah.
Heck of a time.
But I look
anyway,
forward to seeing some of it.
The next film.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Anyway, and the next film. But anyway, let's get to more business of what's been going on in the film world since we've been gone. The big thing, a lot of movies have came out over Christmas break or in December. The biggest one that we have actually yet to talk about on here was Star Wars.
Yes.
We haven't actually talked on here at all.
We've
about
all been
Star
pretty
Wars.
Vocal on social media, if anyone is following us on social media, but we haven't been able to put an episode out.
I revised my critically acclaimed article questioning what happens if Star Wars sucks.
He did. He asked, he's preparing his next article. What if episode 8 sucks, is what he's preparing
for. No. I think we put that question to bed. I revised the article to basically just say it doesn't, and you should go see it. It's
but
a great
film. To be fair, if we're going to dig back into the prequels, you know, Thomas watched, what is it, Attack
I
of
did.
The Clones a lot over the break.
I watched
the conclusion
all
was
of them.
What? It was the worst one of all?
I watched the Machete Order over break, which yeah. I have we talked? I think you guys talked about it during the Star Wars episode, but it's 4, 5. One is optional. Anna talked me into watching 1, 2, 3, 6. I had not seen any of the prequels since theaters. And I think my conclusion was 1 is more famous for being bad because it's fun to talk about how bad it is. But 2 is by far the worst. The dialogue between Anakin and Padme in 2 is so much worse than anything that Jar Jar could impose, any of Jar Jar's poop jokes in episode 1. It's like George Lucas.
Ben might have something. Yeah, Ben could have the idea here for why episode 8.
Yeah, but in that parallel, that means, I'm not saying episode 1 was good, I'm just saying it was not as bad as 2. Because 2 is like George Lucas trying to write Shakespeare, and it's miserable.
I don't like sand. Oh, it's coarse and rough.
Oh. Oh, man, what a glorious, glorious movie. You know what, though? I really loved, really, really loved Force Awakens. Like, man.
It's just fun. I've seen it twice now. It's just a fun movie.
Yeah. It's worth seeing again. It's worth the multiple.
And
watch.
Thomas and I had a discussion last night about this. We went to see The Revenant, and we talked about Revenant and Star Wars afterwards. And I want you to kind of talk about, Thomas, as kind of the backlash Star Wars is getting.
Well, the thing that I said is I am a person, especially, you know, as a film student. A lot of times you're encouraged to not enjoy blockbuster, kind of large audience film, massive films like that.
Yes.
Even at, you know, USC, the birthplace of George Lucas, there's a lot of professors who would encourage you not to like films like that. But I tend to enjoy them, but I also tend to see their faults. As like a huge Marvel fan, I enjoyed watching Age of Ultron, but I also totally agreed with most of the criticism of it. But yeah, the two, what I was telling Brandon was The Force Awakens, I just can't see the people, and I mean, I know some people who passionately hate this film and are going on like social media campaigns that say this film is stupid and you're an idiot if you like it. And I really can't grasp it. I can see, you know, the some people who have a problem with, yes, there are some plot points that line up with the original Star Wars film, but also, I mean, it's the film is Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. And I mean, everything's a hero's journey, but and
I think,
yeah,
well, yeah, no, I've been, you were mentioning people were kind of trying to make noise about it. And to me, it just represents like, there's a contingent of people, like if something becomes exceptionally popular, you know, the only way to get attention within that landscape of reviews or commentary is to be the one standing to the side saying, no, it's terrible, you should listen to me because of these reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very unwarranted in the case of this film, because yeah. It's a great film. Mm-hmm. And if you're reviewing it from most of the angles that I've seen that dismiss it, you're totally missing the point. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
And I want to unfollow you and unlike you, and you know what I mean? Because it's like a call for like a call for help, or you know what I mean? Like it's just it's attention seeking yeah. in the most petty way. I haven't seen any critiques of it that I really think are
and
meaningful.
I feel like the main point everybody comes back to is, hey, they blow up, you know, they blow up a plant, they blow up the Death Star in A New Hope, and they're blowing up Starkiller. they're trying to blow up a battle station in the new one, and you know. I having seen it a second time now, as the plot points kind of fall to the background and the character development shines, I really think that this Lawrence Kasdan and J.J. Abrams have created very strong, interesting, fresh characters for this movie, and I think that is what deserves to be recognized, and that's what the people who are criticizing it for having similar plot points are really doing a disservice to the character development that is going on in this film.
Yeah,
yeah,
I agree too. I also, it reminds me a lot of, and Brandon and I talked about this at one point, the Jesse Eisenberg article in the New Yorker a couple months ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
reminds
yeah, yeah.
me of that so much, man. Just people hating on things just to be cool. Like, man. Like, thanks for bringing that up, Ben, but yeah, it's just so sad.
Yeah, and also, I want to also single out Michael Arndt, who is the original writer for Star Wars Force Awakens, who kind of laid the groundwork, and they brought J.J. and mm-hmm. Lawrence Kasdan. Also, too, it's like we're talking about the hero's journey. For people who don't know what that is, it was a theory that Joseph Campbell did in a book called Hero of a Thousand Faces, where basically showing that religion and stories, they all kind of follow this one hero, and they kind of always go through the same obstacles. And George Lucas and many screenwriters nowadays, actually, George Lucas specifically was the big one that took it and implemented it into the Star Wars universe. And a lot of people do it nowadays. Most Hollywood action films.
Well, and I mean, George Lucas was only doing it because Westerns did it. Like, it's a perpetuating cycle.
Yeah, it's the same thing. So it's like, it's being singled out right now because Star Wars used it. And they're just reusing that thing. It's not really the same in how it's done. Like the step, that's not the beat by beat the same mm-hmm. to me. There are some things that are similar, but it's not like a huge rehash that people say, or like that even George Lucas says. And the other argument people would bring up, talking about how it's like kids film as a children's film or whatever. There was a thing that we'll share in the show notes from I think the third from Return of the Jedi or the sixth one, I guess. It was back in the 80s, and it was Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, and they were debating with this New York film critic who was talking about how Star Wars was this terrible, terrible movie, and that it makes people dumber when they watch it, and it was made for children, and it's going to make all of the kids stupid forever. And Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel were two that were very saying, no, you're completely wrong. This is a smart movie. This is a fun movie. And we've watched it with kids. We've been in a theater with kids, and we've seen it. And this shows how great Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel were. And like this New York guy was just so highbrow, and he suggested, instead of seeing Star Wars, go see Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall, which is this very subtle drama, which is nothing like Star Wars. This debate has been happening for years. And
you know, it kind of crosses over in a small way to not to always bring it around to Netflix, but they they put out an article recently from one of the executives talking about how The five-star system that they use is kind of flawed because people have this bias imposed on them by critics, I think. People have an internal critic, but then they also have a sense of like, well, I shouldn't like this movie because I know other people have told me I shouldn't like it. It's a, you know, some people will use the term guilty pleasure or whatever. Yeah. And that actually really distorts, like Netflix has enough data, obviously, to know that like, well, clearly people love Adam Sandler movies, even if they give them low ratings. So what do you go off of in that case? Like, people are watching it, you know, people may say they don't like it, but it's, you know, his new one, whatever, Ridiculous Six or whatever it is,
is one of
the, you know, top rated film or the most watched, not rated, but top watched properties that they've ever put on the service. And, you know, they're one of their key metrics is just time on the site, usage of the service.
Yeah.
And I just think it's interesting that, like you're saying, these like, I mean, like, I know the stuff that like my son wants to watch, and it's not going to be Tender Mercies. It never will be. And to me, like the role of media at that stage of life, at an early stage of life, is not necessarily like this dense, complex understanding of like human emotions necessarily. I mean, that's great if that comes along, but a lot of it is just like wonder and excitement and curiosity and like seeing other worlds and like talking through all the different things and the characters and just expanding what they, you know, think about. And a lot of that is fantasy. You know what I mean? It's going to be sci-fi. Yeah. Like, I think that's a great genre for a lot of this stuff. Like, this is so much better than so many other things that are, you know, popular among kids. Like, please watch Star Wars as opposed to most of the other stuff that gets that's popular, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I keep now I'm thinking like, what would my life be like if I had grown up playing with Tender Mercy Legos instead of Star Wars Legos? And that's not a world I want to live in.
You'd be a more nuanced individual, Hunter.
Granted, Tender Mercies to me is a great movie, but it is nothing like Star Wars. Like, it's like Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel's like to this big New York critic, he's like, what are you talking about? Like, you can't recommend, you gotta take it in the context of what it is that the person who's gonna, like, no one, like, I had a professor that one time said, he goes, no one just says, I want to watch a great drama. Like, everyone, like, will say, like, I want to watch a comedy, I want to watch a great action film. No one says, you know what, I just want to go watch a great drama. I really need that right now for my life. Because at the end of the day, they want to be entertained. And now there are great dramas out there, and that's, I mean, a lot of stuff I love. But yeah, it's just, that's a debate that I think will happen for a while and has been happening for a while. I mean, we had a professor yesterday talk about how they were dumb and how some people said it killed Star Wars, killed off the way movies were should have been.
Well, and Brandon, I don't have as much of a problem as I was there for that.
I was there for that lecture.
I don't have a problem with that. If you say I don't like blockbuster movies, I only like dramas, that's your taste. But that, I think that's different from the people, especially the people who like, you know, the original people who watch blockbusters coming out against Star Wars is what's really confusing with me. But like, I mean, if you draw the line in the sand, I don't like blockbusters, I'm not going to blame you for that. I am someone who lives purely in the middle zone. I will go see the, you know, the biggest blockbuster that's out right now and go next door and see, you know, the tiny indie foreign film about, I don't know, vegetarian bunnies that are starving to death and
Funicula.
I mean, you know, about Funicula. Whatever. you know, I purely enjoy both types of independent and like gigantic blockbuster films, but I there are people out there that go either way, and you can't blame them for that. I'm the person that goes like, ugh, you know, I don't know, you're going to see Twilight 7, ugh, but I try not to be that person, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it is still just a matter of taste. And yeah.
Speaking of taste, can we talk about Revenant? Because that's all I'm thinking about for the last 48 hours. It's so good.
I haven't seen it, guys, so let's...
We got too used to Ben having seen things now. We have to start dialing it back.
I did go on a pretty good streak, guys. I saw The Big Short. We could talk about The Big Short.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I did love The Big Short.
Yeah, but let's go with The Revenant because Hunter really wants to talk about it. Thomas and I saw it last night at like 11 o'clock at night. And also, too, it just, we'll come back to this later, but it pulled in 12 Oscar nominations today, the most of any film this year.
Well deserved.
And I love someone it got like best, had it got an Oscar for best production design, and someone's like, good job, Outdoors, you did well.
Oh man, they need to get best makeup purely for Leo's chapped lips.
Oh my god. Yes.
Or that neck deal.
His lips. Oh man.
His lips so painful. Was all I was thinking about at the end. I was just like, is that makeup or is that his lips? Because I don't know. Because they're just like gone.
At that point, though, that could have been his real lips.
Exactly. You don't know. It's like,
ain't afraid to die anymore.
Yeah. But anyway, so Ben, The Revenant is, some people compared it, and Thomas and I talked about this last night too. Some people compare it to Terrence Malick, like, and it's all visuals and no substance, which I know Thomas disagrees, and I disagree with as well.
I also disagree.
Well, yeah, just to clarify what you're saying, you're saying Malick light, right?
Light, yeah. Sorry. Yeah,
then I've seen that comment, and, you know, it is, there is definitely a lot of room below regular Malick to be light and still really good, because I love Malick, but, I mean, my goodness, that man is not known for making accessible works.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what, debate that's that, it. But, I was told, you know, Malick like... or Malick Light, and I'm a huge Malick fan, but I understand that Malick's storylines are often very subjective. You kind of put what you want into the storyline. So I personally took a lot out of Tree of Life. Tree of Life was the last time I really cried during a movie. And I know people who watch it and thought it was a bunch of nonsense. But I
love that movie.
Did not take that away from Revenant at all. Watching Revenant, the story, I feel like the story is there. It's totally accessible. It's driving the plot constantly. I never felt like I was having to grasp for meaning. And yes, the visuals are great, but I never felt like I was searching for meaning in the visuals during the film. That's another thing. Kind of like, I can't understand people talking bad about Star Wars. I can't understand people saying that The Revenant isn't accessible. It's hard to watch, yes, maybe, because of the brutality, but the story is right there in front of you.
Yeah, because the thing about The Revenant is that people, they thought it was going to be, and it is very, it gets, I won't say experimental, but it gets kind of surreal in moments. But at the end of the day, the story is about a man who is motivated by revenge. He's motivated by finding this person who left him to die. And for... It's revealed in the trailers that kills his son. I mean, that's what happens. That's what the whole story is.
Killed my boy.
And it's like, it's motivated by that entire thing. And what's also too is that it doesn't just stick with DiCaprio. It goes back and forth to all these different storylines that they all have these motivations. They all have these wants. It's not all surreal. There are surreal moments to it, but the movie is very accessible and has it's not a complex story. It's a very simple story, but it motivates throughout. It's motivated by this main character's want, and it goes. It's a 2.5 hour long movie, and I didn't think it went like. I didn't think it was slow.
No,
at all.
That was the end of a very long day of classes, and I felt totally compelled and gripped by it the whole time we were watching it.
I mean, is anyone disappointed that Alejandro would have experimental or surreal moments in the film?
No,
isn't that the reason you go see one of his films?
They also totally fit.
What I don't understand about some of these criticisms. Like, what were you expecting when you went to see Star Wars? You wanted a think piece? You need to go see something else. If you wanted something that was, like, not surreal and, you know, whatever, then don't go see an Alejandro. Like,
well, and I felt in this one, I think this is... easily his most accessible film, and that even the parts that are a little experimental are totally justifiable. They all come at these points that are like fever dreams for this starved, lost man, you know, coming in and out of consciousness in the wilderness.
Yeah.
So can I use this to a short segue into The Big Short?
Absolutely.
With the fact that Adam McKay directed, and part of, have you guys all seen it? We're not spoiling anything here. I mean, part of what threw me, because I love the book, I love the topic, I had high hopes in a sense because of the cast, because of the promotion of the film, and I had seen some of the interviews with Adam McKay, and the fact that he directed, I mean, I think his style comes through very heavily, and I think in some ways that's kind of what, you know, people, it threw me off, honestly, like the structure of it, the editing of it, especially in the opening 10 minutes or so. I understand and spent time kind of thinking through, like, well, how would I do it? You know what I mean? What do I, what did I want? But I think I did want a more serious film, I think, for a serious topic. Like, I wanted, I mean, it definitely comes off with an opinion. It definitely comes off with what we potentially should have done or could have done. I mean, the book is very heavy-handed towards the end. There's an interview in the audiobook at the end with the author saying, you know, all these reforms have to happen. There's no way that we don't have these reforms. And, of course, that interview was a couple years after the crisis, and we know now that none of those reforms have taken place. So, I mean, he was exceptionally opinionated throughout the book. But in the film, I don't know, there's almost a, you know, because he's commenting on capitalism, because he's commenting on, like, the excesses of our time, I don't, it to me, it almost felt, like, trivial. Like, it in a way, it trivialized. I'm going on about it here, but I was left a little disappointed with it.
Well, you have to take into account, because that movie... it had to be accessible to the audience, and I think, I haven't read the book, but I think certain points just are, people won't get,
because
it's so, it's not a documentary,
right?
It needs to, it's a narrative movie, and I think they did a good job with the things that were just hard to understand. They found a way to explain it in a interesting way. And really, I think some very bold and some bold ways, some bold choices were made that I just thought, like, I don't know of a movie that would do something like this. Like,
well, it's unique, and that and that's what I kind of have settled on after seeing it. Is like, I appreciate that it was just different. You know, I appreciate that they didn't take a completely cookie cutter approach, and I love Gosling stopping and talking to camera. Like, I thought that was that was great. I love Gosling. And I thought a lot of the performances were stellar.
Christian Bale, that was mine. Bale was the best.
Christian Bale was great. Almost entirely by himself for.
But he doesn't interact with any of the other characters in the entire. Spoiler alert: he doesn't interact with any of the characters in the movie.
Well, he's got those great scenes where he goes to Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, and he's kind of sitting there at the conference room table saying, "I'd like to set up this market, please," and they're like, "We're going to take your money if you make these bets. We just think that you're crazy." And he's like, okay.
But I mean, he doesn't interact with, like, Steve, it's like with Steve Carell and, and the people who are promoted, like, who are marketed as the big stars. But I thought Big Short is one that's gotten a lot of acclaim. And it might be because it's such a different style of a movie, of narrative and the structure and the editing of it. It's very, has this documentary approach to it, the way it's shot, the way it's edited. It's very like a fly on
Brandon,
the wall.
I said, especially, I was talking it over with my roommate after viewing it, and I think I was expressing my feelings about it towards Euthana, and what he came back with was that it sounded like what I was saying was that it felt like a really high budget, well acted reenactment show on TV. You know, one of the, not like a true crime thing or something. It feels almost, it feels educational. They're there to teach you something, but to have fun with it.
I enjoyed that. And I also, going back to what Ben said, you know, this is also like Michael Lewis, the author of the book, also wrote Moneyball, also starring Brad Pitt, the movie adaptation. They did a, have you read Moneyball as well, Ben?
I haven't read that one. I've seen the movie, but didn't read the
book. Okay, so they take the idea of the book and, like, some of the core principles of it, but there's, it goes into way more detail in the book, and they really do a good job of honing that down into something that you can understand. because there's no way they could have translated that perfectly over. And I think the same thing goes with Big Short, because there's so much that they had to pack in there that they wanted you to pick it up yourself, but also, like, they had to inject some stuff in there where you figured it out.
I totally agree. Like,
combination.
From reading it, I instantly thought, like, whoever is adapting this is going to have a tough time, because it is so information dense. Like, there's so much in it. And it is a topic that very few people give two shits about, honestly. I don't know if, you know, whatever. But the film that it reminded me of, in a way that I think kind of distorted my feelings on it, is it reminded me of Wolf of Wall Street, in the sense that they're breaking that fourth wall. Obviously it's about Wall Street, and they've got a lot of those things where they're kind of playing up the excess of it all. And I think both films, I think my feelings towards both films is similar, which is just, you know, it's almost glamorizing something that seems like a dessert. I'd almost like more of the, like, House of Cards sort of treatment, where it's like you have, it draws you in, and you break the fourth wall, and you let people in on really complicated politics and problems, but there's a much darker hue to it. Because really, like, what, Steve Carell is the only really morally troubled person. I mean, you know, Brad Pitt has his thing about don't dance, you know, but that's kind of it.
I think you can argue Christian Bale too. I think so. I think at least towards
the end. I don't know if he has any sort of moral.
No, I'd agree with Thomas.
I don't know. I think he kind of does. I mean, I think at the end, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, I think at the end he doesn't care anymore. Like, he did what he did, but he doesn't take it the same way other people do.
So one thing in the book that I was kind of surprised they never really hit on in the film is that that character
has Asperger's,
right? Is that you're gonna talk about? Yeah. His son gets diagnosed in the book, and then his wife is like, "Well, maybe you should get tested." And he's like, "What are you talking about?" You know, and he comes to find out that he's on the spectrum, and then he starts to understand his son. He starts to understand himself. It's really kind of a beautiful section of the book, and I feel it's strange in the movie that it's never really addressed. I mean, we get from the performance that he's off. You know what I mean? He's not normal, but to not state it in some way makes it, again, kind of weird to me.
Well, I heard that was in the movie originally.
Interesting.
I had heard that was in the movie originally, and that because of the way it was tested, people really didn't need it for that to be explained.
And to be honest, I don't know. Maybe it's something that comes in pairs. From the point where I watched it, I watched it. I enjoyed it. I learned. I laughed. I was not totally engaged in it as a story, and I think for that which does not in any way say that I didn't enjoy it, but for that reason I didn't feel like I needed, like, Steve Carell's character arc that much, because he was the only, and I guess that's kind of because they took out the Asperger stuff with Christian Bale's character, that it felt really weirdly personal that we didn't know that much about anyone involved, except for we're going deep into Steve Carell's moral and personal motivations, which was felt strange for me. I don't know, but
I agree with that. I mean, his performance is great, but it does kind of come through a little hollow in the context of, like, the broader like the themes and the tone of it. My favorite performance from the film is actually Vinny, the guy that plays opposite Steve Carell, in several of those key moments at the end when they're battling back and forth. I felt like that was really, he represented really, like, the interaction that I wanted more of the film to have, which is that back and forth over, you know, what should we do and what's driving them. And so much of that early first two-thirds of the film is just kind of, you know, we're celebrating these guys like heroes, and the book kind of does as well, but we're also, like Brad Pitt says, we're celebrating the undermining of everything. You know, it's totally destroying the entire global economy.
Quick side note, you brought up Vinny. I have to admit, this movie made me like Jerry Dantana again, and I never thought in a million years that I'd like Jerry Dantana ever again.
Same.
Continue, Ben.
No, I mean, let's. We do have to, you know, keep it a little short tonight. We've been going, but
let's segue into the Oscars.
Yeah,
let's segue into the Oscars. We're talking about Revenant. We're talking about Big Short. All and even Star Wars are films that were nominated today at the Oscars. And I actually stayed up to watch.
You stayed awake from the Revenant,
dude. He was up this morning. I was up and I just woke up late in Atlanta, and he's still awake in L.A. And I was like, "The hell is wrong with you?"
I haven't slept past like 8:30 in forever, and I woke up at like 10:30 this morning to just Oscar texts and this morning. For those listening, this is also the morning that Alan Rickman passed away, so a lot of Alan Rickman texts.
Yeah,
we're gonna
talk about that. Yeah, and it was. I stayed up and watched the Oscars streaming it, and there were some surprises in it as well, but also not that many. The Revenant got 12 nominations, and then Mad Max, which about 3 months ago wasn't really talked about in the Oscars, and had 10 nominations. So Tom Hardy movies are having a great year. And then The Martian had the third most nominations with 7. And Bridge of Spies had, I think, 6. Carol had 6. It was very spread out. Spotlight had 6. Room had 4. Brooklyn had 3. Star Wars had 5. But the big things, there were 8. The thing about the Oscars, which is it's still really weird, is that they can accept 5 to 10 nominations. Mm. And the way the process goes, you have to get a certain percentage of first place votes. So that means people have to say it as like the number one movie of the year or whatever. And so we haven't had, I don't think we've had 10 since they had the whole like, guess what it's going to be. We haven't had 10 since they made that change. And the big thing, Room I was surprised about, because that was a very small movie that I didn't think had enough buzz to get into the best picture.
It had the Ben buzz, though. It had the Ben buzz.
Had the Ben buzz.
Well, all I was doing was calling Bree early. We could talk about Room after you see it, Brandon, because I don't know that it should be on this list. Just
throw that out there. I mean, it received Best Actress with Brie Larson. It received Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Picture. So it had a lot of the big ones, and they also said that the young kid was snubbed for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to nominate Brie, you have to nominate his performance I'm a big Brie Larson fan, but his performance is like what's surprising about her as the lead. Well, you should see it. Well, yeah. Anyway, I'll say it because it enough people. This is you've far missed the spoiler alert window of this film. This has been out a long time. You like that?
In major cities.
This is not a big spoiler, but the arc of the film is not centered around Brie. And I think that's something to talk about after you see it is the structure of the film is kind of strange.
Yeah, but I was surprised that it pulled off 4 nominations. And the thing is, the big surprise is that it got 4 nominations and Best Picture. I haven't seen this movie, but Carol got 6 nominations, but not Best Picture, which was somewhat surprising, is that it landed for Best Actress, Best Actress in a Supporting Role, Best Cinematography, Best Costume Design, Best Original Score, looking at all the things it got nominated for, Best Adapted Screenplay. And so it got some big nominations, and it didn't get Best Picture, which is somewhat surprising. Well,
and something else that it's not as much of a surprise now that, you know, the smaller awards have been happening, but walking out, I mean, I think I don't want to lose sight of how astonishing it would be now if I were to transport back in time to when I walked out of the theater from Mad Max or The Martian. Like, I thoroughly enjoyed those films, but I never would have thought we'd see either of them up for an Academy Award for Best Picture. Yeah, which is it's just fun. I like that.
I mean, that's the big thing is that over half of the Best Picture nominations are studio films.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Bridge of Spies is Disney technically? Mad Max, I think I can't remember what Mad Max was. Was it Fox?
Warner Brothers, I believe.
Yeah. Warner Bros. Okay. Revenant was Fox. The Martian, I'm not sure what it was. And then Big Short was Paramount. So that's some fairly big, I mean, studio films that got nominations. But I want to talk about a little bit the things that were kind of snubs.
Hashtag and Oscar so white.
Oscar so white. This is the biggest thing to me. And a lot of people argue, and I do kind of agree, is that I do agree that there were not people of color, or there weren't African-American based stories. And they've had a lot of movies. We've had a lot of movies this year. Straight Outta Compton being the biggest one, which I think I said tonight, I think it was personally a travesty that it wasn't nominated for Best Picture, because I thought it was one of the best films of the year. And I think if you look to a lot of the awards before this, PGA, or Producers Guild, Writers Guild, SAT, or Screen Actors Guild, and National Board of Review have all nominated it in their best of the year categories. PGA gave it best film, best production. WGA gave it nominated for best screenplay. SAG, best ensemble. And it gets best screenplay, and that's it at the Oscars.
And Brandon, in the direction that you're going, I totally agree with you that, yes, there's something off with the nominations here, but also we just need to, I feel like every year the Academy Awards bear the same, like the full brunt of the, you know, the Oscars so white, you know, where are our diverse nominations? But I feel like the problem at this point is with the Hollywood system. And especially like last year when this year you've got several. You've got Straight Outta Compton is left off. You've got
Beasts of No Nation
is left off. You've got Creed. The only thing coming out of Creed is Stallone getting nominated. But like last year, you know, when you've just got everyone going, where's Selma? Like we shouldn't be in a situation where there's one, you know, all the Oscar hopes for an African-American actor or director riding on one movie. Like that just shouldn't be the situation that we're in.
Totally no, agree. I don't. Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think that's the case though this year. I mean, it's not as bad as Selma because Selma was just, that was kind of the only one. But this year you had Straight Outta Compton, which had the nominations these other places. Beasts of No Nation with Idris Elba, who had one at SAG and I think one at Golden Globes for Best Supporting Actor. And Beasts of No Nation also had Best Ensemble at SAG as well, which only nominates five movies.
Those kids are incredible.
Dude, you're forgetting about Creed, the greatest movie of the year.
No, I'm bringing it up. Creed, which I think, reinvented the Rocky franchise, and to me, and Stallone is to me the best part of the movie. But you had Michael B. Jordan.
Do you think they're just punishing him for Fan 4 Stick still?
Maybe. Yeah. But I think Creed should have been nominated for Best Picture as well.
Dude, Tessa Thompson was great in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie was great all around. There are a few parts I was, small things, and that might be just because I look very hard at a Rocky movie, but I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think it should have been talked about, or at least been and nominated for Best Picture. And then you have the big one that I haven't seen the movie yet, but he had a Golden Globe nomination. That was Will Smith for Concussion. I mean, he had nominations elsewhere, and he hasn't even been talked about since then, even though people like his performance. I haven't seen it, so I can't really comment. But
talk about someone in the doghouse, though.
But yeah, I can comment that Straight Outta Compton should have been nominated for more than what was nominated for.
Well, but let's talk about something pretty simple though, from an economic standpoint, which is there's a bump that you get from being nominated, from being considered, from being talked about, and to be completely snubbed on some of these films. I mean, Beasts of No Nation, because of its connection to Netflix, its poor box office performance, I can understand there's some flaws in the film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I sent you guys a pretty cool interview, which maybe we can add to the show notes, with director Cary Fukunaga. And basically they just ran out. They just didn't have the money. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the money for the third act. You know, so some of those things, like I don't know that deserves Best Picture, but Idris Elba not being nominated, you can go down a long list of things that could be substituted here. I mean, I don't think Room deserves to be on this list. I personally don't really know if Spotlight deserves to be on this list. I mean, we can fight over some of these things, but to just have a straight run of so many traditional films and to leave out some of these new voices, and not even new voices, just great voices, right? I mean, like, why? It's hard to figure out other than to call it, like, systemic bias, right? I mean, there's just, I don't understand how some of these films could be absent. Just like Ava last year not getting nominated is just bizarre.
Yeah, but and like what I'm saying is we live in such a culture where we get, you know, politically we get enraged by like what's happening right now, and so it's easy to start talking about it when the Academy Awards happen and then just kind of give up, you know, maybe right before the Academy Awards happen or even on the night of, and then just kind of be done with it. But I think this continues to be an overarching problem. It's, you know, the Academy Awards are just a symptom of, you know, what's happening.
And I mean, Viola Davis said a few years ago when she I can't remember which award that she won for, when she talked about how it's hard to have people get nominated when there's not really parts being invented for people like of minorities. It's like, it's not there. I mean, if you look at all the best pictures, which are all, I think, great films, the ones I've seen, there's no parts really for African Americans or even Hispanics or anything like that. It's mostly.
Well, and you can extend it further, and it's been talked about this year as well for women, just like the number of roles for women that are interesting, that what's the Bechdel test? I mean, like, there's so many films that are popular, make tons of money, and genuinely don't have two women who are named characters who talk in a scene about something other than the other men in the movie. I mean, that is such a low bar. And of course, we're four dudes sitting around talking about this, but four white dudes talking about this. But yeah, I agree with Thomas. I mean, I think it really poorly reflects an industry that is. It matters in the sense that it's supposed to reflect our like broader culture and also be like, I think the coolest part about some of this stuff is we're going to look back on these films that are nominated in 20, 30 years and debate whether they deserved it. And some of these films who were not nominated will not be a part of that discussion because they weren't nominated. Mm. You know, like you said, Thomas, the controversy will be long gone and over. And the Guardian article about where these films were and why they got snubbed will not be the point of focus. It will be relegated to the history books of these were the nominees. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's probably the disappointment.
Well, let's I'm gonna ask you guys this question since we can wrap up with the Oscar stuff. Who do you guys think will win Best Picture? I'm just gonna keep it short. Who do you think's gonna win Best Picture?
I'm gonna go Revenant. It might just be that it's freshest in my mind, but I think if we're looking at the big picture, I'd say Revenant.
Hunter.
I'm gonna go Revenant too.
Okay. Ben.
Just
make an educated guess.
Yeah. I don't want to say Revenant. I haven't seen it. I don't really want to say The Martian because I don't think it deserves it. I don't really want to say Spotlight.
Tell us how you really feel, Ben.
Yeah.
Mad Max, I guess. I don't know. I haven't seen enough of these films to really do battle for them.
Here's what I'll say. I would actually want Mad Max to win.
I do too. I would love it.
That would be cool.
I would be happy with that. Martian or Revenant. I'm fine, dude. It's a great year for me.
But I'm gonna say this, and I'll tell you why I'm saying this. I'm gonna say Spotlight. And let me give you the reasons why. Because there are valid reasons. When you look at the best original screenplay and best adapted screenplay of probably the past decade, the eventual Best Picture winner is always nominated and always wins. The only exception is The Artist. Every other movie, if it's not nominated for Best Original Screenplay or Best Adapted Screenplay, it usually does not win. Avatar, Gravity, both were not nominated for Best Original or Adapted Screenplay, and neither won Best Picture and went someone else. So I think screenplay has a very major effect on who wins Best Picture. Now, you can argue that there's not much dialogue in Revenant or Mad Max, and that could help it, like how Artist had no dialogue. But I think that correlates a lot with what's happening.
I think you might be right, Brandon, based on history and all that, but it just should have been a miniseries. Like, I think the movie is just not nearly as good as it could have been. It opens up so many questions. It would have been a blockbuster, you know, 10 episode special on HBO or Netflix, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Well, I think
it's a great story that deserves a fuller palette.
I'd say it does have a great script, but I kind of feel about Spotlight the same way I feel about The Big Short. I was very interested by the story, but I never felt totally captivated by the character arc or anything like that.
Yeah, but yeah, it's the thing is, I still think it's so up in the air because I think this is just a very, very difficult year. I'm just looking at history, and I could be completely wrong because history is not always right. I mean, it's a very difficult year.
History isn't always right, and who won the USC Oscar pool last year?
By one.
Thomas won.
By one.
Okay, all right. Thomas. Well, we'll have a Facebook or some sort of contest for everybody to get their opinions in, and
yeah, and let's wrap this up real quick. I want to bring this up because lately, this past few weeks, and at the very end of 2015, and now we've lost a lot of great artists. Late December, we lost Haskell Wexler, who was a great cinematographer. Vimos Zsigmond, who was also a great cinematographer, did Close Encounters of the Third Kind, died a few weeks ago. This past week, we've lost David Bowie at 69 to cancer, and the big one that just happened today was Alan Rickman, who died at 69 due to cancer as well. And Alan Rickman, everyone has big ones, but Alan Rickman it's a very difficult one for a lot of people. And I thought we should bring that up and talk about it. I know Ben had in our show notes about what was everyone's favorite performance by Alan Rickman? And we'll just sum it up. We'll end it with that.
By Grapthar's hammer, you shall be avenged. Galaxy Quest. I would never even try and impersonate the great, but he's got some great moments in that film.
Hunter?
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Okay.
Dude, that movie is moving for that character. Like, oh my goodness. I watched the movie about a month ago around Christmas with my stepsister, and I honestly had forgotten so much about that movie. Dude, I cried again because Snape. Like, damn, that's a great character. Full circle, man. Full circle. That's a great movie.
Thomas, real quick.
I want to say Die Hard, but I have to say, after all this time, it's the same as Hunter's, always.
And
because you guys are twinsies, or I don't know.
No, that's a quote. That's a quote.
That's a quote. And I will also say Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, because Snape. Huh? What, Ben?
Would you guys be surprised if I told you I've never read nor seen any of the Harry Potter films?
You're missing out on one of the biggest character arcs of my life.
We just lost fans because of that, Ben. This
whole podcast is basically a slow unraveling of the facade the fact that I've actually watched anything. Basically, this is just a slow reveal of what I have not seen.
Yeah, well, I will say Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows Part 2 because Snape's character to me is the most complex character of that franchise to me, and one of my favorite characters. And I think we lost a great actor today, and I know he'll be truly missed. We'll talk more about him and other people we've lost because we'll probably do an in memoriam episode at some point. And yeah, it's a very, very sad day for the film community, theater community, and I know our thoughts and prayers are with his family and also just the people who we've also lost this year and the end of last year. So, hate to end on that somber note, but we'll do our plugs real quick. You can follow us on Twitter at Cinenation Show and on Facebook at Cinenation. And then we have a few things coming up. Hunter, you want to mention your
Bad Movie Book Club, Anaconda? It's coming soon. Going to squeeze the life out of you.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man, it's going to be awesome. Watched it again today for the second time in a week. I cannot wait.
We're going to record the episode. We're going to record the episode in terrible South American accents in honor of John
Voight. It's going to be so amazing. I can't wait. That, and also go check out Anna's new video that she posted on our Medium account. It's really, really good. Yeah. It's Twin Peaks. It's a coffee tribute. And it's really good.
And we've got some really cool. I spent a couple days after Star Wars curating some awesome Star Wars articles. So check out Medium if you enjoyed The Force Awakens, or even if you didn't, because we have a bad review on there, which is good.
Well, we'll also have an upcoming episode, I'm pretty sure, about global Netflix.
Yes.
It didn't really, you know, land on a lot of people's radar with the news stories. There were a couple brief ones, but there's actually, not that I talk a lot about it,
should
but there's
Barry
a lot
back?
To talk about.
Let's try to get Barry back.
We'll definitely
Barry
come back.
Amazing. I love that episode, guys. It was a great episode.
Talk to Barry.
Great way to end the year too. Well, I mean, honestly, that was a heck of, it was amazing. Yeah. Good job.
Yeah. And we're trying to set up more interviews too for the future. We'll provide you guys with more information once we get it. But yeah, thank you guys for listening and happy new year and go to the movies and
see Revenant because it's amazing.
Thank you guys for listening.